26. Jed lit a cigarette with a wood kitchen match, shook it out, and tossed the stub into a tin ashtray with a barely readable Jim Beam advertisement painted on its bottom.
Yeah, it was Stanley Bouchard who told me about the place.
He paused, thinking. Barely touched glasses of beer stood before them on the checked oilcloth that covered the kitchen table. Behind them, the barrel of range oil clamped to the wall gurgled three times, deliberately, and was still. Lewis had caught a pickup supper with Steve, submarine sandwiches in the mostly deserted bear's den. He had found out early that if you asked for a hoagie or a grinder or a gyro in Maine, they didn't know what you were talking about. Ask for a sub or a Whop burger and you were in business. With some food in him, Lewis began to feel better about Church's return, felt that he had things more in perspective, but he was still not anxious to return to his dark, empty house where the cat could be, let's face it, gang, anywhere at all. Norma sat with him for quite a while, watching TV and working on a sampler that showed the sun going down behind a small county meeting house. The cross on the roof tree was silhouetted black against the setting sun. Something to sell, she said, at the church sale the week before Christmas. Always a big event. Her fingers moved well, pushing the needle through the cloth, pulling it up through the steel circle. Her arthritis was barely noticeable tonight. Lewis supposed it might be the weather, which had been cold but very dry. She had recovered nicely from her heart attack, and on that evening, less than 10 weeks before a cerebral accident would kill her, he thought that she looked less haggard and actually younger. On that evening, he could see the girl she had been. At 9:45, she said good night, and now he sat here with Judd, who had ceased speaking and seemed only to be following his cigarette smoke up and up like a kid watching a barber pole to see where the stripes go. "Stanny B," Lewis prompted gently. Judd blinked and seemed to come back to himself.
"Oh, yeah," he said. "Everyone in Ludlow, round Bucksport and Prospect and Arrington too, I guess, just called him Stanny B. That year my dog Spot died. 1910, I mean, the first time he died. Stanny was already an old man and more than a little crazy. There was others around these parts that knew the Micmac burying ground was there, but it was Stanny B. I heard it from. And he knew about it from his father and his father before him. A whole family of proper Canucks, they were."
Judd laughed and sipped his beer.
"I can still hear him talking in that broken English of his. He found me sitting behind the livery stable that used to stand on Route 15, except it was the Bangor-Bucksport road back then, right about where the Orinco plant is now. Spot wasn't dead, but he was going, and my dad sent me away to check on some chicken feed, which old Yorkie sold back then. We didn't need chicken feed any more than a cow needs a blackboard, and I knew well enough why he sent me down there."
He was going to kill the dog.
"He knew how tenderly I felt about Spot, so he sent me away while he did it. I saw about the chicken feed, and while old Yorkie set it out for me, I went around back and sat down on the old grindstone that used to be there and just bawled."
Judd shook his head slowly and gently, still smiling a little.
"Then along comes old Stanny B," he said. "Half the people in town thought he was soft, and the other half thought he might be dangerous. His grandfather was a big fur trapper and trader in the early 1800s. Stanley's grandpa would go all the way from the Maritimes to Bangor and Derry, sometimes as far south as Skowhegan to buy pelts, or so I've heard. He drove a big wagon covered with rawhide strips, like something out of a medicine show. He had crosses all over it, for he was a proper Christian and would preach on the resurrection when he was drunk enough. This is what Stanley said. He loved to talk about his grandpa. But he had pagan Indian signs all over it as well, because he believed that all Indians, no matter what the tribe, belonged to one big tribe. That lost one of Israel the Bible talks about. He said he believed all Indians were hellbound, but that their magic worked because they were Christians all the same in some queer, damned way. Stanley's grandpa bought from the Micmacs and did a good business with them long after most of the other trappers and traders had given up or gone west, because he traded with them at a fair price, because, Stanley said, he knew the whole Bible by heart, and the Micmacs liked to hear him speak the words the Black Robes had spoken to them in the years before the buckskin men and woodsmen came. He fell silent. Lewis waited. The Micmacs told Stanyby's granddaughter about the burying ground, which they didn't use anymore because the Wendigo had soured the ground, and about Little God's Swamp and the steps and all the rest. The Wendigo story, now, that was something you could hear in those days all over the North Country. It was a story they had to have, the same way I guess we have to have some of our Christian stories. Norma would damn me for a profaner if she heard me say that, but Lewis, it's true. Sometimes, if the winter was long and hard and the food was short, there were North Country Indians who would finally get down to the bad place where it was starve or do something else. Cannibalism? Judd shrugged. Maybe. Maybe they'd pick out someone who was old and used up. Then there would be stew for a while. And the story they worked out would be that the Wendigo had walked through their village or encampment while they were sleeping and touched them. And the Wendigo was supposed to give those it touched a taste for the flesh of their own kind. Lewis nodded, saying the devil made them do it. Sure. My own guess is that the Micmacs around here had to do it at some point, and that they buried the bones of whoever they ate, one or two, maybe even 10 or 12, up there in their burying ground. And then decided the ground had gone sour, Lewis muttered. So here's Stanley B. Come out in back of the livery to get his jug, I guess, Judd said. Already half-crocked he was. His grandfather was worth maybe $1 million when he died, or so people said, and Stanley B. was nothing but the local rag man. He asked me what was wrong, and I told him. He saw I'd been bawling, and he told me there was a way it could be fixed up if I was brave and sure I wanted it fixed up. I said I'd give anything to have Spot well again, and I asked him if he knew a vet that could do it. Don't know no vet me, Stanley said. But I know how to fix your dog, boy. You go home now and tell your dad to put that dog in a grain sack. But you ain't going to bury him, no. You're going to drag him up to the pet cemetery and you're going to put him in the shade by that big deadfall. Then you're going to come back and say it's done. I asked him what good that would do, and Stanley told me to stay awake that night and come out when he threw a stone against my window. And it'd be midnight, boy, so if you forget Stanley B. and go to sleep, Stanley B. gonna forget you, and it's goodbye, dog. Let him go straight to hell. Judd looked at Lewis and lit another cigarette. It went just the way Stanley set it up. When I got back, my dad said he'd put a bullet in Spot's head to spare him any more suffering. I didn't even have to say anything about the pet cemetery. My dad asked me if I didn't think Spot would want me to bury him up there, and I said I guess he would. So off I went, dragging my dog in a grain sack. My dad asked me if I wanted help, and I said no because I remembered what Stanley B. said. I laid awake that night. Forever, seemed like. You know how time is for kids. It would seem to me I must have stayed awake right around until morning, and then the clock would only chime 10 or 11. A couple of times I almost nodded off, but each time I snapped wide awake again. It was almost as if someone had shaken me and said, "Wake up, Judd, wake up," like something wanted to make sure I stayed awake. Lewis raised his eyebrows at that, and Judd shrugged. When the clock in the downstairs hall chimed 12, I got right up and sat there dressed on my bed with the moon shining in the window. Next I know, the clock is chiming the half hour. Then 1 o'clock. And still no Stanley B. He's forgot all about me, that dumb Frenchman, I think to myself. And I'm getting ready to take my clothes off again when these 2 pebbles whap off the window, damn near hard enough to break the glass. One of them did put a crack in the pane, but I never noticed it until the next morning. And my mother didn't see it until the next winter, and by then she thought the frost done it. I just about flew across to that window and heaved it up. It grated and rumbled against the frame, the way they only seem to do when you're a kid and you want to get out after midnight. Lewis laughed, even though he could not remember ever having wanted to get out of the house at some dark hour when he was a boy of 10. Still, if he had wanted to, he was sure that windows which had never creaked in the daytime would creak then. I figured my folks must have thought burglars were trying to break in. But when my heart quieted down, I could hear my dad still sawing wood in the bedroom on the first floor. I looked out, and there was Stanny B. standing in our driveway and looking up, swaying like there was a high wind when there wasn't so much as a puff of breeze. I don't think he ever would have come, Lewis, except that he'd gotten to that stage of drunkenness where you're as wide awake as an owl with diarrhea, and you just don't give a care about anything. And he sort of yells up at me, only I guess he thought he was whispering, "You coming down, boy, or am I coming up to get you?" "Shh," I says, scared to death now that my dad will wake up and give me the whopping of my young life. "What did you say?" Stanny says, even louder than before. If my parents had been around on the roadside of this house, Lewis, I would have been a goner. But they had the bedroom that belongs to Norma and me now, with the river view. "I bet you got down those stairs in one hell of a hurry," Lewis said. "Have you got another beer, Judd?" He was already two past his usual limit, but tonight that seemed okay. Tonight that seemed almost mandatory. "I do, and you know where they're kept," Judd said, and lit a fresh smoke. He waited until Lewis was seated again. "No, I wouldn't have dared to try the stairs. They went past my parents' bedroom. They went down the ivy trellis, hand over hand, just as quick as I could. I was some scared, I can tell you, but I think I was more scared of my dad just then than I was of going up to the pet cemetery with Stanny B." He crushed out his smoke. "We went up there, the two of us, and I guess Stanny B. must have fallen down half a dozen times if he fell down once. He was really far gone. Smelled like he'd fallen into a vat of corn. One time he damn near put a stick through his throat, but he had a pick and shovel with him. When we got to the pet cemetery, I kind of expected he'd sling me the pick and shovel and just pass out while I dug the hole. Instead, he seemed to sober up a little. He told me we was going on, up over the deadfall and deeper into the woods, where there was another burial place. I looked at Stanny, who was so drunk he could barely keep his feet. And I looked at that deadfall, and I said, 'You can't climb that, Stanny B., you'll break your neck.' And he said, 'I ain't gonna break my neck, me, and neither are you. I can walk, and you can lug your dog.' And he was right. He sailed up over that deadfall just as smooth as silk, never even looking down. And I lugged Spot all the way up there, although he must have weighed 35 pounds or so, and I only went about 90 myself. I want to tell you, though, Lewis, I was some sore and sprung the next day. How do you feel today?" Lewis didn't answer, only nodded. "We walked and we walked," Judd said. "It seemed to me we was going to walk forever. The woods were spookier in those days. More birds calling from the trees, and you didn't know what any of them was. Animals moving around out there. Deer, most likely. But back then there were moose, too, and bears and catamounts. I dragged Spot. After a while, I started to get the funny idea that old Stanny B. was gone, and I was following an Indian. Following an Indian, and somewhere farther along, he'd turn around, all grinning and black-eyed, his face streaked up with that stinking paint they made from bear fat, that he'd have a tomahawk made out of a wedge of slate and a hake of ash wood all tied together with rawhide, and he'd grab me by the back of the neck and whack off my hair, along with the top of my skull. Stanny wasn't staggering or falling anymore. He just walked straight and easy, with his head up, and that sort of helped to feed the idea. But when we got to the edge of the Little God Swamp and he turned around and talked to me, I seen it was Stanny, all right. And the reason he wasn't staggering or falling anymore was because he was scared. Scared himself sober, he did. He told me the same things I told you last night about the loons and the St. Elmo's fire and how I wasn't to take any notice of anything I saw or heard. Most of all, he said, 'Don't speak to anything if it should speak to you.' Then we started across the swamp. And I did see something. I ain't going to tell you what, only that I've been up there maybe 5 times since that time when I was 10, and I've never seen anything like it again. Nor will I, Lewis. because my trip to the Micmac burial place last night was my last trip.
I'm not sitting here believing all of this, am I? Lewis asked himself almost conversationally. The three beers helped him to sound conversational, at least to his own mind's ear.
I am not sitting here believing the story of old Frenchmen and Indian burying grounds and something called the Wendigo and pets that come back to life, am I?
For Christ's sake, the cat was stunned, that's all. A car hit it and stunned it. No big deal. This is a senile old man's maunderings.
Except that it wasn't, and Lewis knew it wasn't. And three beers wasn't going to cure that knowing. And 33 beers wouldn't. Church had been dead. That was one thing. He was alive now, and that was another. There was something fundamentally different, fundamentally wrong about him. And that was a third. Something had happened. Judd had repaid what he saw as a favor. But the medicine available at the Micmac burying ground was perhaps not such good medicine. And Lewis now saw something in Judd's eyes that told him the old man knew it. Lewis thought of what he had seen, or thought he had seen, in Judd's eyes the night before. That capering, gleeful thing. He remembered thinking that Judd's decision to take Lewis and Ellie's cat on that particular night journey had not entirely been Judd's own. If not his, then whose, his mind asked. And because he had no answer, Lewis swept the uncomfortable question away.
I buried Spot and built the cairn, Judd went on flatly, and by the time I was done, Stanny B was fast asleep. I had to shake the hell out of him to get him going again, but by the time we got down those 44 stairs...
45, Lewis muttered.
Judd nodded. Yeah, that's right, ain't it? 45. By the time we got down those 45 stairs, he was walking as steady as if he was sober again. We went back through the swamp and the woods and over the deadfall, and finally we crossed the road and we was at my house again. It seemed to me like 10 hours must have gone past, but it was still full dark.
What happens now? I asked Danny B.
Now you wait and see what may happen, Stanny says, and off he walks, staggering and lurching again. I imagine he slipped out in back of the livery that night, and as things turned out, my dog Spot outlived Stanny B by 2 years. His liver went bad and poisoned him, and two little kids found him in the road on July 4th, 1912, stiff as a poker. But me, that night, I just climbed back up the ivy and got into bed and fell asleep almost as soon as my head touched the pillow. Next morning, I didn't get up until almost 9 o'clock, and then my mother was calling me. My dad worked on the railroad, and he would have been gone since 6.
Judd paused, thinking.
My mother wasn't just calling me, Lewis. She was screaming for me.
Judd went to the fridge, got himself a Miller's, and opened it on the drawer handle below the bread box and toaster. His face looked yellow in the overhead light, the color of nicotine. He drained half his beer, uttered a belch like a gunshot, and then glanced down the hall toward the room where Norma slept. He looked back at Lewis.
This is hard for me to talk about, he said. I have turned it over in my mind years and years, but I've never told anyone about it. Others knew what had happened, but they never talked to me about it. The way it is about sex, I guess. I'm telling you, Lewis, because you've got a different kind of pet now. Not necessarily a dangerous one, but different. Do you find that's true?
Lewis thought of Church jumping awkwardly off the toilet seat, his haunches thudding against the side of the tub. He thought of those muddy eyes that were almost but not quite stupid staring into his own. At last he nodded.
When I got downstairs, my mother was backed into a corner in the pantry between her icebox and one of the counters. There was a bunch of white stuff on the floor, curtains she'd been meaning to hang. Standing in the doorway of the pantry was Spot, my dog. There was dirt all over him and mud splashed clear up his legs. The fur on his belly was filthy, all knotted and snarled. He was just standing there, not growling or nothing, just standing there. But it was pretty clear that he had backed her into a corner, whether he meant to or not. She was in terror, Lewis. I don't know how you felt about your parents, but I know how I felt about mine. I loved them both dearly.
Knowing I'd done something to put my own mother in terror took away any joy I might have felt when I saw Spot standing there. I didn't even seem to feel surprised that he was there.
I know the feeling, Lewis said. When I saw Church this morning, it seemed like something that was...
He paused a moment.
Perfectly natural?
Those were the words that came immediately to mind, but they were not the right words.
Like something that was meant.
Yes, Judd said. He lit a fresh cigarette. His hands were shaking the smallest bit.
And my mother seen me there, still in my underwear, and she screamed at me, "Feed your dog, Judd. Your dog needs to be fed. Get him out of here before he messes the curtains."
So I found him some scraps, and I called him, and at first he didn't come. At first it was like he didn't know his own name, and I almost thought, well, this ain't Spot at all. It's some stray that looks like Spot, that's all.
Yes, Lewis exclaimed.
Judd nodded. But the second or third time I called him, he came. He sort of jerked toward me. And when I let him out onto the porch, damned if he didn't run right into the side of the door and just about fall over. He ate the scraps, though, just wolfed them down. By then I was over my first fright, and I was starting to get an idea of what had happened. I got on my knees and hugged him. I was so glad to see him. Then he licked my face and...
Judd shuddered and finished his beer.
Lewis, his tongue was cold. Being licked by Spot was like getting rubbed up the side of your face with a dead carp.
For a moment, neither of them spoke. Then Lewis said, "Go on."
He ate, and when he was done, I got an old tub we kept for him out from under the back porch, and I gave him a bath. Spot always hated to have a bath. Usually it took both me and my dad to do it, and we'd end up with our shirts off and our pants soaked, my dad cussing and Spot looking sort of ashamed, the way dogs do. And more likely than not, he'd roll around in the dirt right after, and then go over by my mother's clothesline to shake off and put dirt all over the sheets she had hung. And she'd scream at both of us that she was going to shoot that dog for a stranger before she got much older. But that day, Spot just sat in the tub and let me wash him. He never moved at all. I didn't like it. It was like washing meat. I got an old piece of towel after I gave him his bath and dried him all off. I could see the places where the barbed wire had hooked him. There was no fur in any of those places, and the flesh looked dimpled in. It is the way an old wound looks after it's been healed 5 years and more.
Lewis nodded. In his line of work, he had seen such things from time to time. The wound never seemed to fill in completely, and that made him think of graves and his days as an undertaker's apprentice, and how there was never enough dirt to fill them in again. Then I saw his head. There was another of those dimples there, but the fur had grown back white in a little circle. It was near his ear.
Where your father shot him, Lewis said.
Judd nodded.
Shooting a man or an animal in the head isn't as surefire as it sounds, Judd. There would be suicides in vegetable wards, or even walking around, right as rain, who didn't know that a bullet can strike the skull plate and travel right around it in a semicircle, exiting the other side without ever penetrating the brain. I personally saw one case where a fellow shot himself above the right ear and died because the bullet went around his head and tore open his jugular vein on the other side of his head. That bullet path looked like a county road map.
Judd smiled and nodded.
I remember reading something like that in one of Norma's newspapers, The Star, The Enquirer, one of those. But if my pop said Spot was gone, Lewis, he was gone.
All right, Lewis said. If you say that's how it was, that's how it was.
Was your daughter's cat gone?
I sure thought it was, Lewis said.
You got to do better than that. You're a doctor.
You make it sound like you got to do better than that, Lewis. You're God.
I'm not God.
It was dark.
Sure it was dark.
And his head swiveled on his neck like it was full of ball bearings.
And when you moved him, he pulled out of the frost, Lewis. Sounded like a piece of sticky tape coming off a letter.
Live things don't do that. You only stop melting the frost under where you're laying when you're dead.
In the other room, the clock struck 10:30. What did your father say when he came home and saw the dog? Lewis asked.
I was out in the driveway, shooting marbles in the dirt, more or less waiting for him. I felt like I always felt when I'd done something wrong and knew I was probably gonna get a spanking. He came in through the gateposts about 8 o'clock, wearing his bib overalls and his pilotic cap. You ever seen one of those?
Lewis nodded, then stifled a yawn with the back of his hand.
Yeah, getting late, Judd said. Got to finish this up.
It's not that late, Lewis said. I'm just a few beers ahead of my usual pace. Go on, Judd. Take your time. I want to hear this.
My dad had an old lard tin he kept his dinner in, Judd said. And he come in through the gate, swinging it empty, by the handle, you know. Whistling something. It was getting dark, but he seen me there in the gloom, and he says, "Hi there, Judkins," like he would do, and then, "Where's your..." He got that far, and then here comes Spot out of the dark, not running like he usually did, ready to jump all over him, he was so glad to see him, but just walking, wagging his tail. And my dad dropped that lard bucket and stepped back. I don't know what he would have turned tail and run except his back hit the picket fence. And then he just stood there, looking at the dog. And when Spot did jump up, Dad just caught his paws and held them like you might hold a lady's hand you was getting ready to dance with. He looked at the dog for a long time, and then he looked at me, and he said, "He needs a bath, Judd. He stinks of the ground you buried him in." And then he went in the house.
"What did you do?" Lewis asked.
"Gave him another bath. He just sat there in the tub and took it again. And when I went in the house, my mother had gone to bed, even though it wasn't even 9 o'clock. My dad said, 'We got to talk, Judkins.' And I sat down across from him, and he talked to me like a man for the first time in my life, with the smell of the honeysuckle coming across the road from what's your house now, and the smell of the wild roses from our own house."
Judd Crandall sighed.
"I'd always thought it would be good to have him talk to me that way, but it wasn't. It wasn't a bit good. All this tonight, Lewis, it's like when you look into a mirror that's been set up right across from another mirror, and you can see yourself going down a whole hall of mirrors. How many times has this story been passed along, I wonder? A story that's just the same, except for the names. And that's like the sex thing, too, isn't it?"
"Your dad knew all about it."
"Yeah. Who took you up there, Judd?" he asked me. And I told him. He just nodded like it was what he would have expected. I guess it probably was, although I found out later that there were 6 or 8 people in Ludlow at that time that could have taken me up there. I guess he knew that Stanley B. was the only one crazy enough to have actually done it."
"Did you ask him why he didn't take you, Judd?"
"I did," Judd said. "Somewhere during that long talk I did ask him that. And he said it was a bad place, by and large, and that it didn't often do anything good for people who had lost their animals, or for the animals themselves. He asked me if I liked Spot the way he was. And you know, Lewis, I had the hardest time answering that. And it's important that I tell you my feelings on that, because sooner or later you're going to ask me why I led you up there with your daughter's cat, if it was a bad thing to do. Isn't that so?"
Lewis nodded. What was Ellie going to think about church when she got back? That had been much on his mind while he and Steve Masterton had been playing racquetball that afternoon.
"Maybe I did it because kids need to know that sometimes dead is better," Judd said with some difficulty. "That's something your Ellie don't know. And I got a feeling that maybe she don't know because your wife don't know. Now you go ahead and tell me if I'm wrong, and we'll leave it."
Lewis opened his mouth and then closed it again. Judd went on, now speaking very slowly, appearing to move from word to word as they had moved from hummock to hummock in Little God Swamp the night before.
"I've seen it happen over the years," he said.
I guess I told you that Lester Morgan buried his prize bull up there. Black Angus, named Hanratty. Ain't that a silly name for a bull? Died of some sort of ulcer inside, and Lester dragged him all the way up there on a sledge. How he did it, how he got over the deadfall there, I dunno. But it's said that what you want to do, you can. And at least, as far as that burying ground goes, I'd say it's true. Well, Hanratty came back. But Lester shot him dead 2 weeks later. That bull turned mean, really mean. But he's the only animal I ever heard of that did. Most of them just seem a little stupid, a little slow, a little dead. Yeah, Judd said. A little dead. Like they'd been somewhere and came back. But not all the way. Now, your daughter isn't going to know that, Lewis. Not that her cat was hit by a car and killed and came back. So you could say you can't teach a child a lesson unless the child knows there's a lesson to be learned. Except sometimes you can, Lewis said, more to himself than to Judd. Yes, Judd agreed. Sometimes you can. Maybe she'll learn something about what death really is, which is where the pain stops and the good memories begin. Not the end of life, but the end of pain. You don't tell her those things. She will figure them out on her own. And if she's anything like me, she'll go on loving her pet. It won't turn vicious or bite or anything like that. She'll go on loving it. But she'll draw her own conclusions, and she'll breathe a sigh of relief when it finally dies. That's why you took me up there, Lewis said. He felt better now. He had an explanation. It was diffuse. It relied more upon the logic of the nerve endings than the logic of the rational mind. But under the circumstances, he found he could accept that. And it meant he could forget the expression he thought he had seen on Judd's face briefly last night. That dark, capering glee. Okay, that's abruptly, almost shockingly, Judd covered his face with both hands. For one moment, Lewis thought he had been struck by a sudden pain, and he half rose, concerned, until he saw the convulsive heave of the chest and realized that the old man was struggling not to cry. That's why, but it ain't why, he said in a strangled, choked voice. I did it for the same reason Stanley B. did it, and for the same reason Lester Morgan did it. Lester took Linda Levesque up there after her dog got run over in the road. He took her up there even though he had to put his goddamn bull out of its misery for chasing kids through its pasture like it was mad. He did it anyway. He did it anyway, Lewis, Judd almost moaned. And what the Christ do you make of that? Judd, what are you talking about? Lewis asked, alarmed. Lester did it and Stanley did it for the same reason I did it. You do it because it gets hold of you. You do it because that burial place is a secret place, and you want to share the secret. And when you find a reason that seems good enough, why... Judd took his hands away from his face and looked at Lewis with eyes that seemed incredibly ancient, incredibly haggard. Why, then you just go ahead and do it. You make up reasons. They seem like good reasons. But mostly you do it because you want to, or because you have to. My dad, he didn't take me up there because he'd heard about it. But he'd never been. Stanley B. had been up there, and he took me. And 70 years ago, by... And then, all at once... Judd shook his head and coughed dryly into the palm of his hand. Listen, he said. Listen, Lewis. Lester's bull was the only damn animal I ever knew of that turned really mean. I believe that Mrs. Levesque's little chow might have bit the postman once, after. And I heard a few other things, animals that got a little nasty. But Spot was always a good dog. He always smelled like dirt. It didn't matter how many times you washed him. He always smelled like dirt, but he was a good dog. My mother would never touch him afterward. But he was a good dog just the same. But, Lewis, if you was to take your cat out tonight and kill it, I would never say a word. That place, all at once it gets hold of you, and you make up the sweetest-smelling reasons in the world. But I could have been wrong, Lewis. That's all I'm saying. Lester could have been wrong. Stenny B. could have been wrong. Hell, I ain't God either. But bringing the dead back to life, that's about as close to playing God as you can get, ain't it? Lewis opened his mouth again, then closed it again. What would have come out would have sounded wrong. Wrong and cruel. Judd, I didn't go through all that just to kill the damn cat again. Judd drained his beer and then put it carefully aside with the other empties. I guess that's it, he said. I am talked out. Can I ask you one other question? Lewis asked. I guess so, Judd said. Lewis said, Has anyone ever buried a person up there? Judd's arm jerked convulsively. Two of the beer bottles fell off the table, and one of them shattered. Christ on his throne, he said to Lewis. No, and whoever would. You don't even want to talk about such things, Lewis. I was just curious, Lewis said uneasily. Some things it don't pay to be curious about, Judd Crandall said. And for the first time he looked really old and infirm to Lewis Creed, as if he were standing somewhere in the neighborhood of his own freshly prepared grave. And later, at home, something else occurred to him about how Judd had looked at that moment. He had looked like he was lying. 27. Lewis didn't really know he was drunk until he got back in his own garage. Outside there was starlight, and a chilly rind of moon. Not enough light to cast a shadow, but enough to see by. Once he got in the garage, he was blind. There was a light switch somewhere, but he was damned if he could remember any more just where it was. He felt his way along slowly, shuffling his feet, his head swimming, anticipating a painful crack on the knee or a toy that he would stumble over, frightening himself with its crash, perhaps falling over himself. Ellie's little Schwinn with its red training wheels. Gage's crawly gator. Where was the cat? Had he left him in? Somehow he sailed off course and ran into the wall. A splinter whispered into one palm and he cried out shit to the darkness, realizing after the word was out that it sounded more scared than mad. The whole garage seemed to have taken a stealthy half turn. Now it wasn't just the light switch. Now he didn't know where the fuck anything was, and that included the door into the kitchen. He began walking again, moving slowly, his palms stinging. This is what it would be like to be blind, he thought. And that made him think of a Stevie Wonder concert he and Rachel had gone to, when, 6 years ago? As impossible as it seemed, it had to be. She'd been pregnant with Ellie then. Two guys had led Wonder to his synthesizer, guiding him over the cables that snaked across the stage so he wouldn't stumble. And later, when he had gotten up to dance with one of the backup singers, she had led him carefully to a clear place on the floor. He had danced well, Lewis remembered thinking. He had danced well, but he had needed a hand to lead him to the space where he could do it. How about a hand right now to lead me to my kitchen door, he thought, and abruptly shuddered. If a hand came out of the darkness now to lead him, how he would scream. Scream and scream and scream. He stood still, heart thudding. Come on, he told himself. Stop this shit. Come on, come on. Where was that fucking cat? Then he did slam into something, the rear bumper of the station wagon, and the pain sang up his body from his barked chin, making his eyes water. He grabbed his leg and rubbed it, standing one-legged like a heron, but at least he knew where he was now, the geography of the garage fixed firmly in his mind again, and besides, his night vision was coming, good old visual purple. He had left the cat in, he remembered that now, hadn't really wanted to touch it, to pick it up and put it out and... And that was when Church's hot, furry body oiled against his ankle like a low eddy of water, followed by its loathsome tail curling against his calf like a clutching snake. And then Lewis did scream. He opened his mouth wide and screamed. 28. Daddy! Ellie screamed. She She ran up the jetway toward him, weaving in and out between deplaning passengers like a quarterback on a keeper play. Most of them stood aside, grinning. Lewis was a little embarrassed by her ardor, but he felt a large, stupid grin spreading across his own face just the same. Rachel was carrying Gage in her arms, and he saw Lewis when Ellie shouted. "Daddy!" he yelled exuberantly, and began to wriggle in Rachel's arms. She smiled, a trifle wearily, Lewis thought, and set him on his feet. He began to run after Ellie, his legs pumping busily. "Daddy! Daddy!" Lewis had time to notice that Gage was wearing a jumper he had never seen before. It looked like more of Granda's work to Lewis. Then Ellie hurtled into him and shinnied up him like a tree. "Hi, Daddy!" she bellowed and smacked his cheek heartily. "Hi, hon," he said, and bent over to catch Gage. He pulled him up into the crook of his arm and hugged them both. "I'm glad to see you back." Rachel came up then, her traveling bag and pocketbook slung over one arm. Gage's diaper bag slung over the other. "I'll be a big boy soon," was printed on the side of the diaper bag, a sentiment probably meant more to cheer up the parents than the diaper-wearing child. She looked like a professional photographer at the end of a long, grueling assignment. Lewis bent between his two kids and planted a kiss on her mouth. "Hi." "Hi, Doc," she said and smiled. "You look beat." "I am beat. We got as far as Boston with no problem. We changed planes with no problem. We took off with no problem. But as the plane is banking over the city, Gage looks down and says, 'Pretty, pretty,' and then whoopses all over himself." "Oh, Jesus. I got him changed in the toilet," she said. "I don't think it's a virus or anything. He was just air sick." "Come on home," Lewis said. "I've got chili on the stove." "Chili, chili," Ellie screamed in Lewis's ear, transported with delight and excitement. "Chili, chili," Gage screamed in Lewis's other ear, which at least equalized the ringing. "Come on," Lewis said. "Let's get your suitcases and blow this joint." "Daddy, how's church?" Ellie asked as he set her down. It was a question Lewis had expected, but not Ellie's anxious face and the deep worry line that appeared between her dark blue eyes. Lewis frowned and then glanced at Rachel. "She woke up screaming over the weekend," Rachel said quietly. "She had a nightmare." "I dreamed that church got run over," Ellie said. "Too many turkey sandwiches after the big day, that's my guess," Rachel said. "She had a bout of diarrhea, too. Set her mind at rest, Lewis, and let's get out of this airport. I've seen enough airports in the last week to last me for at least 5 years." "Why, church is fine, honey," Lewis said slowly. "Yes, he's fine. He lies around the house all day long and looks at me with those strange, muddy eyes, as if he'd seen something that had blasted away most of whatever intelligence a cat has. He's just great. I put him out with a broom at night because I don't like to touch him. I just kind of sweep at him with it, and he goes. And the other day, when I opened the door, Ellie, he had a mouse, or what was left of it. He'd strewed the guts hell to breakfast. And speaking of breakfast, I skipped mine that morning. Otherwise, he's just fine." "Oh," Ellie said, and that furrow between her eyes smoothed out. "Oh, that's good. When I had that dream, I was sure he was dead." "Were you?" Lewis asked and smiled. "Dreams are funny, aren't they?" "Dreams," Gage hollered. He had reached the parrot stage that Lewis remembered from Ellie's development. "Dreams!" He gave Lewis's hair a hearty tug. "Come on, gang," Lewis said, and they started down to the baggage area. They had gotten as far as the station wagon in the parking lot when Gage began saying, "Pretty, pretty," in a strange hiccuping voice. This time he whooped all over Lewis, who had put on a new pair of double-knit slacks for the plane meeting occasion. Apparently Gage thought "pretty" was the code word for "I've got to throw up now, so sorry, stand clear." It turned out to be a virus after all. By the time they had driven the 17 miles from Bangor Airport to their house in Ludlow, Gage had begun to show signs of fever and had fallen into an uncomfortable doze. Lewis backed into the garage, and out of the corner of his eye he saw Church slink along one wall, tail up, strange eyes fixed on the car. It disappeared into the dying glow of the day, and a moment later Lewis saw a disemboweled mouse lying beside a stack of four summer tires. He had the snows put on while Rachel and the kids were gone. The mouse's innards glowed pink and raw in the garage's gloom. Lewis got out quickly and purposely bumped against the pile of tires, which were stacked up like black checkers. The top two fell over and covered the mouse. "Oops,"
he said.
"You're a spaz, Daddy," Ellie said, not unkindly.
"That's right," Lewis said with a kind of hectic cheer. He felt a little like saying, "Pretty, pretty," and blowing his groceries all over everything.
"Daddy's a spaz."
He could remember Church killing only a single rat before his queer resurrection. He sometimes cornered mice and played with them in that deadly cat way that ultimately ends in destruction. But he or Ellie or Rachel had always intervened before the end. And once cats were fixed, he knew, few of them would do more than give a mouse an interested stare, at least as long as they were well fed.
"Are you going to stand there dreaming, or help me with this kid?" Rachel asked.
"Come back from Planet Mongo, Dr. Creed. Earth people need you." She sounded tired and irritable.
"I'm sorry, babe," Lewis said.
He came around to get Gage, who was now as hot as the coals in a banked stove. So only the three of them ate Lewis's famous Southside chili that night. Gage reclined on the living room sofa, feverish and apathetic, drinking a bottle filled with lukewarm chicken broth and watching a cartoon show on TV. After dinner, Ellie went to the garage door and called Church. Lewis, who was doing the dishes while Rachel unpacked upstairs, hoped the cat wouldn't come, but he did. He came in, walking in his new slow lurch, and he came almost at once, as if it, had been lurking out there. Lurking. The word came immediately to mind.
"Church!" Ellie cried. "Hi, Church!"
She picked the cat up and hugged it. Lewis watched out of the corner of his eye. His hands, which had been groping on the bottom of the sink for any leftover silverware, were still. He saw Ellie's happy face change slowly to puzzlement. The cat lay quietly in her arms, its ears laid back, its eyes on hers. After a long moment, it seemed very long to Lewis, she put Church down. The cat padded away toward the dining room without looking back.
"Executioner of small mice," Lewis thought randomly. "Christ, what did we do that night?"
He tried honestly to remember, but it already seemed far away, dim and distant, like the messy death of Victor Pascal on the floor of the infirmary's reception room. He could remember carriages of wind passing in the sky and the white glimmer of snow in the back field which rose to the woods. That was all.
"Daddy?"
Ellie said in a low, subdued voice.
"What, Ellie?"
"Church smells funny."
"Does he?" Lewis asked, his voice carefully neutral.
"Yes," Ellie said, distressed.
"Yes, he does. He never smelled funny before. He smells like caca."
"Well, maybe he rolled in something bad, honey," Lewis said. "Whatever that bad smell is, he'll lose it."
"I certainly hope so," Ellie said in a comical dowager's voice. She walked off.
Lewis found the last fork, washed it, and pulled the plug. He stood at the sink, looking out into the night while the soapy water ran down the drain with a thick, chuckling sound. When the sound from the drain was gone, he could hear the wind outside, thin and wild, coming from the north, bringing down winter. And he realized he was afraid. Simply, stupidly afraid. The way you are afraid when a cloud suddenly sails across the sun and somewhere you hear a ticking sound you can't account for.
103? Rachel asked.
"Jesus, Lou, are you sure?"
"It's a virus," Lewis said.
He tried not to let Rachel's voice, which seemed almost accusatory, grate on him. She was tired. It had been a long day for her. She had crossed half the country with her kids today. Here it was 11 o'clock, and the day wasn't over yet. Ellie was deeply asleep in her room. Gage was on their bed in a state that could best be described as semi-conscious. Lewis had started him on Liquiprin an hour ago. "The aspirin will bring his fever down by morning, hon."
"Aren't you going to give him ampicillin or anything?"
Patiently, Lewis said, "If he had the flu or a strep infection, I would. He doesn't. He's got a virus, and that stuff doesn't do doodly squat for viruses. It would just give him the runs and dehydrate him more."
"Are you sure it's a virus?"
"Well, if you want a second opinion," Lewis snapped, "be my guest."
"You don't have to shout at me," Rachel shouted.
"I wasn't shouting," Lewis shouted back.
"You were," Rachel began. "You were shouting.
And then her mouth began to quiver, and she put a hand up to her face. Lewis saw there were deep gray-brown pockets under her eyes and felt badly ashamed of himself. "I'm sorry," he said and sat down beside her. "Christ, I don't know what's the matter with me. I apologize, Rachel." "Never complain, never explain," she said, smiling wanly. "Isn't that what you told me once? The trip was a bitch, and I've been afraid you'd hit the roof when you looked in Gage's dresser drawers. I guess maybe I ought to tell you now while you're feeling sorry for me." "What's to hit the roof about?" She smiled wanly. "My mother and father bought him 10 new outfits. He was wearing one of them today. I noticed he had on something new," he said shortly. "I noticed you noticing," she replied, and pulled a comic scowl that made him laugh, although he didn't feel much like laughing. "And 6 new dresses for Ellie." "6 dresses?" he said, strangling the urge to yell. He was suddenly furious, sickly furious and hurt in a way he couldn't explain. "Rachel, why? Why did you let him do that? We don't need... We can buy..." He ceased. His rage had made him inarticulate, and for a moment he saw himself carrying Ellie's dead cat through the woods, shifting the plastic bag from one hand to the other. And all the while, Irwin Goldman, that dirty old fuck from Lake Forest, had been busy trying to buy his daughter's affection by unlimbering the world-famous checkbook and the world-famous fountain pen. For one moment, he felt himself on the verge of shouting, "He bought her 6 dresses, and I brought her goddamn cat back from the dead, so who loves her more?" He clamped down on the words. He would never say anything like that. Never. She touched his neck gently. "Lewis," she said, "it was both of them together. Please try to see. Please. They love the children, and they don't see them much. And they're getting old. Lewis, you'd hardly recognize my father, really."
"I'd recognize him," Lewis muttered.
"Please, honey, try to see. Try to be kind. It doesn't hurt you." He looked at her for a long time.
"It does, though," he said finally. "Maybe it shouldn't, but it does."
She opened her mouth to reply, and then Ellie called out from her room, "Daddy, Mommy, somebody!" Rachel started to get up, and Lewis pulled her back down.
"Stay with Gage. I'll go."
He thought he knew what the trouble was, but he had put the cat out, damn it. After Ellie had gone to bed, he had caught it in the kitchen, sniffing around its dish, and had put it out. He didn't want the cat sleeping with her. Not anymore. Odd thoughts of disease mingled with memories of Uncle Carl's funeral parlor had come to him when he thought of Church sleeping on Ellie's bed. She's going to know that something's wrong, and Church was better before. He had put the cat out, but when he went in, Ellie was sitting up in bed, more asleep than awake, and Church was spread out on the counterpane, a bat-like shadow. The cat's eyes were open and stupidly gleaming in the light from the hall.
"Daddy, put him out," Ellie almost groaned. "He stinks so bad."
"Shh, Ellie, go to sleep," Lewis said, astounded by the calmness of his own voice. It made him think of the morning after his sleepwalking incident, the day after Pascal had died. Getting to the infirmary and ducking into the bathroom to look at himself in the mirror, convinced that he must look like hell. But he had looked pretty much all right. It was enough to make you wonder how many people were going around with dreadful secrets bottled up inside. "It's not a secret, goddammit. It's just the cat." But Ellie was right. It stank to high heaven. He took the cat out of her room and carried it downstairs, trying to breathe through his mouth. There were worse smells. Shit was worse, if you wanted to be perfectly blunt. A month ago, they'd had a go-around with a septic tank, and as Judd had said when he came over to watch Puffer and Sons pump the tank, "That ain't Chanel number 5, is it, Lewis?" The smell of a gangrenous wound, that old Dr. Bracerman at med school had called hot flesh, was worse, too. Even the smell which came from the Civic's catalytic converter when it had been idling in the garage for a while was worse. But this smell was pretty damn bad. And how had the cat gotten in, anyway? He had put it out earlier, sweeping it out with the broom, while all three of them, his people, were upstairs. This was the first time he'd actually held the cat since the day it had come back almost a week ago. It lay hotly in his arms like a quiescent disease, and Lewis wondered, "What bolt hole did you find, you bastard?" He thought suddenly of his dream that other night, Pascal simply passing through the door between the kitchen and the garage. Maybe there was no bolt hole. Maybe it had just passed through the door like a ghost. "Bag that," he whispered aloud, and his voice was slightly hoarse. Lewis became suddenly sure that the cat would begin to struggle in his arms, that it would scratch him. But Church lay totally still, radiating that stupid heat and that dirty stink, looking at Lewis's face as if it could read the thoughts going on behind Lewis's eyes. He opened the door and tossed the cat out into the garage, maybe a little too hard. "Go on," he said. "Kill another mouse or something." Church landed awkwardly, its hindquarters bunching beneath it and momentarily collapsing. It seemed to shoot Lewis a look of green, ugly hate. Then it strolled drunkenly off and was gone. "Christ, Judd," he thought, "but I wish you'd kept your mouth shut." He went to the sink and washed his hands and forearms vigorously as if scrubbing for an operation. "You do it because it gets hold of you. You make up reasons. They seem like good reasons. But mostly you do it because once you've been up there, it's your place and you belong to it. And you make up the sweetest smelling reasons in the world." No, he couldn't blame Judd. He had gone of his own free will, and he couldn't blame Judd. He turned off the water and began to dry his hands and arms. Suddenly the towel stopped moving, and he stared straight ahead, looking out into the little piece of night framed in the window over the sink. "Does that mean it's my place now? That it's mine, too?" "No. Not if I don't want it to be." He slung the towel over the rack and went upstairs. Rachel was in bed, the covers pulled up to her chin, and Gage was tucked in neatly beside her. She looked at Lewis apologetically. "Would you mind, hon, just for tonight? I'd feel better having him with me. He's so hot." "No," Lewis said. "That's fine. I'll pull out the hide-a-bed downstairs." "You really don't mind?" "No. It won't hurt Gage, and it'll make you feel better." He paused, then smiled. "You're going to pick up his virus, though. That comes almost guaranteed. I don't suppose that changes your mind, does it?" She smiled back and shook her head. "What was Ellie fussing about?"
"Church. She wanted me to take Church away."
"Ellie wanted Church taken away? That's a switch."
"Yeah, it is," Lewis agreed, and then added, "She said he smelled bad, and I think he was a little fragrant. Maybe he rolled in a pile of someone's mulch or something."
"That's too bad," Rachel said, rolling over on her side.
"I really think Ellie missed Church as much as she missed you."
"Uh-huh," Lewis said. He bent and kissed her mouth softly. "Go to sleep, Rachel."
"I love you, Lou. I'm glad to be home. And I'm sorry about the couch."
"It's okay," Lewis said, and turned out the light. Downstairs, he stacked the couch cushions, pulled out the hide-a-bed, and tried to prepare himself mentally for a night of having the rod under the thin mattress dig into the small of his back. The bed was sheeted, at least. He wouldn't have to make it up from scratch. Lewis got two blankets from the top shelf in the front hall closet and spread them on the bed. He began to undress, then paused. "You think Church is in again? Fine. Take a walk around and have a look. As you told Rachel, it won't hurt. May even help. And checking to make sure all the doors are on the latch won't even catch you a virus." He took a deliberate tour of the entire downstairs, checking the locks on doors and windows. He had done everything right the first time, and Church was nowhere to be seen. "There," he said. "Let's see you get in tonight, you dumb cat." He followed this with a mental wish that Church would freeze his balls off, except the Church, of course, no longer had any. He switched off the lights and got into bed. The rod started to press into his back almost immediately, and Lewis was thinking he would be awake half the night when he fell asleep. He fell asleep resting uncomfortably on his side in the hide-a-bed. But when he woke up, he was in the burying ground beyond the pet cemetery again. This time he was alone. He had killed Church himself this time, and then had decided for some reason to bring him back to life a second time. God knew why. Lewis didn't. He had buried Church deeper this time, though, and Church couldn't dig his way out. Lewis could hear the cat crying somewhere under the earth, making a sound like a weeping child. The sound came up through the pores of the ground, through its stony flesh. The sound and the smell, that awful, sickish, sweet smell of rot and decay. Just breathing it in made his chest feel heavy,
as if a weight was on it. The crying. The crying. The crying was still going on, and the weight was still on his chest.
Lewis!
It was Rachel, and she sounded alarmed.
Lewis, can you come?
She sounded more than alarmed. She sounded scared, and the crying had a choked, desperate quality to it. It was Gage. He opened his eyes and stared into Church's greenish-yellow eyes. They were less than 4 inches from his own. The cat was on his chest, neatly curled up there like something from an old wife's tale of breath-stealing. The stink came off it in slow, noxious waves. It was purring. Lewis uttered a cry of disgust and surprise. He shot both hands out in a primitive warding-off gesture. Church thumped off the bed, landed on its side, and walked away in that stumbling lurch. Jesus, Jesus, it was on me. Oh, God, it was right on me. His disgust could not have been greater if he had awakened to find a spider in his mouth. For a moment, he thought he was going to throw up.
Lewis!
He pushed the blankets back and stumbled to the stairs. Faint light spilled from their bedroom. Rachel was standing at the head of the stairs in her nightgown.
Lewis, he's vomiting again. Choking on it. I'm scared.
I'm here, he said, and came up to her, thinking, it got in. Somehow it got in. From the cellar, probably. Maybe there's a broken cellar window. In fact, there must be a broken window down there. I'll check it tomorrow when I get home. Hell, before I go to work. Gage stopped crying and began to make an ugly, gargling, choking sound.
Lewis!
Rachel screamed. Lewis moved fast. Gage was on his side, and vomit was trickling out of his mouth onto an old towel Rachel had spread beside him. He was vomiting, yes, but not enough. Most of it was inside, and Gage was blushing with the onset of asphyxiation. Lewis grabbed the boy under the arms, aware in a distant way of how hot his son's armpits were under the Dr. Denton suit, and put him on his shoulder as if to burp him. Then Lewis snapped himself backward, jerking Gage with him. Gage's neck whiplashed. He uttered a loud bark that was not quite a belch, and an amazing flag of almost solid vomit flew from his mouth and spattered on the floor in the dresser. Gage began to cry again, a solid bawling sound that was music to Lewis's ears. To cry like that, you had to be getting an unlimited supply of oxygen. Rachel's knees buckled and she collapsed onto the bed, head supported in her hands. She was shaking violently.
He almost died, didn't he, Lewis? He almost oh, my God!
Lewis walked around the room with his son in his arms. Gage's cries were tapering off to whimperings. He was already almost asleep again. The chances are 50-1 he would have cleared it himself, Rachel. I just gave him a hand.
But he was close, she said.
She looked up at him, and her white-ringed eyes were stunned and unbelieving.
Lewis, he was so close.
Suddenly he remembered her shouting at him in the sunny kitchen. He's not going to die. No one is going to die around here. Honey, Lewis said, we're all close. All the time. It was milk that had almost surely caused the fresh round of vomiting. Gage had awakened around midnight, she said, an hour or so after Lewis had gone to sleep with his hungry cry, and Rachel had gotten him a bottle. She had drowsed off again herself while he was still taking it. About an hour later, the choking spell began. No more milk, Lewis said, and Rachel had agreed, almost humbly. No more milk. Lewis got back downstairs at around 1:45 and spent 15 minutes hunting up the cat. During his search, he found the door which communicated between the kitchen and basement standing ajar, as he suspected he would. He remembered his mother telling him about a cat that had gotten quite good at pawing open old-fashioned latches, such as the one on their cellar door. The cat would just climb the edge of the door, she'd said, and pat the thumb plate of the latch with its paw until the door opened. A cute enough trick, Lewis thought, but not one he intended to allow Church to practice often. There was, after all, a lock on the cellar door, too. He found Church dozing under the stove and tossed it out the front door without ceremony. On his way back to the hide-a-bed, he closed the cellar door again, and this time shot the bolt. 29. In the morning, Gage's temperature was almost normal. His cheeks were chapped, but otherwise he was bright-eyed and full of beans. All at once, in the course of a week, it seemed, his meaningless gabble had turned into a slew of words. He would imitate almost anything you said. What Ellie wanted him to say was shit. Say shit, Gage, Ellie said over her oatmeal. Shit, Gage, Gage responded agreeably over his own cereal. Lewis allowed the cereal, on condition that Gage eat it with only a little sugar. And as usual, Gage seemed to be shampooing with it rather than actually eating it. Ellie dissolved into giggles.
"Say farts, Gage," she said. "Farts, Gage," Gage said, grinning through the oatmeal spread across his face. "Fars and shit."
Ellie and Lewis broke up. It was impossible not to. Rachel was not so amused. "That's enough vulgar talk for one morning, I think," she said, handing Lewis his eggs.
"Shit and fars and shit," Gage sang cheerily, and Ellie hid her giggles in her hands.
Rachel's mouth twitched a little, and Lewis thought she was looking 100% better in spite of her broken rest. A lot of it was relief, Lewis supposed. Gage was better, and she was home.
"Don't say that, Gage," Rachel said.
"Pretty," Gage said as a change of pace, and threw up all the cereal he'd eaten into his bowl.
"Oh, gross, out!"
Ellie screamed and fled the table. Lewis broke up completely then. He couldn't help it. He laughed until he was crying and cried until he was laughing again. Rachel and Gage stared at him as if he had gone crazy.
"No," Lewis could have told them, "I've been crazy, but I think I'm going to be all right now. I really think I am."
He didn't know if it was over or not, but it felt over. Perhaps that would be enough. And for a while, at least, it was. 30. Gage's virus hung on for a week, then cleared up. A week later, he came down with a bout of bronchitis. Ellie also caught this, and then Rachel. During the period before Christmas, the three of them went around hacking like very old and wheezy hunting dogs. Lewis didn't catch it, and Rachel seemed to hold this against him. The final week of classes at the university was a hectic one for Lewis, Steve, Surrendra, and Charlton. There was no flu, at least not yet, but plenty of bronchitis and several cases of mononucleosis and walking pneumonia. 2 days before classes broke for Christmas, 6 moaning drunken fraternity boys were brought in by their concerned friends. There were a few moments of confusion, gruesomely reminiscent of the Pascal affair. All 6 of the damned fools had crammed onto one medium-length toboggan. The 6 had actually been sitting on the shoulders of the tail man, from what Lewis could piece together, and had set off to ride the toboggan down the hill above the steam plant. Hilarious! Except that after gaining a lot of speed, the toboggan had wandered off course and struck one of the Civil War cannons. The score was 2 broken arms, a broken wrist, a total of 7 broken ribs, a concussion, plus contusions far too numerous to count. Only the boy riding on the shoulders of the tail ender had escaped completely unscathed. When the toboggan hit the cannon, this fortunate soul flew over it and landed head first in a snowbank. Cleaning up the human wreckage hadn't been fun, and Lewis had scored all of the boys liberally with his tongue as he stitched and bandaged and stared into pupils. But telling Rachel about it later, he had again laughed until he cried. Rachel had looked at him strangely, not understanding what was so funny, and Lewis couldn't tell her that it had been a stupid accident, and people had been hurt, but they would all walk away from it. His laughter was partly relief, but it was partly triumph, too. 1-1 today, Lewis. The cases of bronchitis in his own family began to clear up around the time that Ellie's school broke for the holidays on December 16th, and the 4 of them settled down to spend a happy and old-fashioned country Christmas. The house in North Ludlow, which had seemed so strange on that day in August when they pulled into the driveway, strange and even hostile, what with Ellie cutting herself out back and Gage getting stung by a bee at almost the same time, had never seemed more like home. After the kids were finally asleep on Christmas Eve, Lewis and Rachel stole downstairs from the attic like thieves, their arms full of brightly colored boxes. A set of matchbox racers for Gage, who had recently discovered the joys of toy cars, Barbie and Ken dolls for Ellie, a turn-and-go, an oversized trike, doll clothes, a play oven with a light bulb inside, other stuff. The two of them sat side by side in the glow of lights from the tree, fussing the stuff together. Rachel in a pair of silk lounging pajamas, Lewis in his robe. He could not remember a more pleasant evening. There was a fire in the fireplace, and every now and then one or the other of them would rise and throw in another chunk of split birch. Winston Churchill brushed by Lewis once, and he pushed the cat away with an almost absent feeling of distaste. That smell. Later he saw Church try to settle down next to Rachel's leg, and Rachel also gave it a push and an impatient scat. A moment later, Lewis saw his wife rubbing her palm on one silk-clad thigh, the way you sometimes do when you feel you might have touched something nasty or germy. He didn't think Rachel was even aware she was doing it. Church ambled over to the brick hearth and collapsed in front of the fire gracelessly. The cat had no grace at all now, it seemed. It had lost it all on that night Lewis rarely allowed himself to think about. And Church had lost something else as well. Lewis had been aware of it, but it had taken him a full month to pinpoint it exactly. The cat never purred anymore, and it used to have one of the loudest motors going, particularly when Church was sleeping. There had been nights when Lewis had had to get up and close Ellie's door so he could get to sleep himself. Now the cat slept like a stone, like the dead. No, he reminded himself, there was one exception. The night he had awakened on the hide-a-bed with Church curled up on his chest like a stinking blanket, Church had been purring that night. He had been making some sound, anyway. But as Judd Crandall had known, or guessed, it had not been all bad. Lewis found a broken window down cellar behind the furnace, and when the glazier fixed it, he had saved them yay bucks in wasted heating oil. For calling his attention to the broken pane, which he might not have discovered for weeks, months maybe, he supposed he even owed Church a vote of thanks. Ellie no longer wanted Church to sleep with her, that was true, but sometimes, when she was watching TV, she would let the cat hop up on her lap and go to sleep. But just as often, he thought, hunting through the bag of plastic widgets that were supposed to hold Ellie's bat cycle together, she would push him down after a few minutes, saying, "Go on, Church, you stink." She fed him regularly and with love, and even Gage was not above giving old Church an occasional tail tug. More in the spirit of friendliness than in one of meanness, Lewis was convinced. He was like a tiny monk yanking a furry bell rope. At these times, Church would crawl lackadaisically under one of the radiators where Gage couldn't get him. "We might have noticed more differences with a dog," Lewis thought. "But cats are such goddamn independent animals anyway. Independent and odd. Fey, even." It didn't surprise him that the old Egyptian queens and pharaohs had wanted their cats mummified and popped into their triangular tombs with them in order to serve as spirit guides in the next world. Cats were weird. "How you doing with that bat cycle, Chief?" He held out the finished product. "Ta-da!" Rachel pointed at the bag, which still had three or four plastic widgets in it. "What are those?" "Spares," Lewis said, smiling guiltily. "You better hope they're spares. The kid will break her rotten little neck." "That comes later," Lewis said maliciously, "when she's 12 and showing off on her new skateboard." She groaned. "Come on, Doc, have a heart." Lewis stood up, put his hands on the small of his back, and twisted his torso. His spine crackled. "That's all the toys. And they're all together. Remember last year?" She giggled, and Lewis smiled. Last year, seemingly everything they'd gotten had to be assembled, and they'd been up until almost 4 o'clock Christmas morning, both of them finishing grouchy and out of sorts. And by mid-afternoon of Christmas, Ellie had decided the boxes were more fun than the toys. "Gross out," Lewis said, imitating Ellie. "Well, come on to bed," Rachel said. "I'll give you a present early." "Woman," Lewis said, drawing himself up to his full height, "that is mine by right." "Don't you wish," she said, and laughed through her hands. In that moment, she looked amazingly like Ellie, and like Gage. "Just a minute," he said. "There's one other thing I gotta do." He hurried into the front hall closet and brought back one of his boots. He removed the fire screen from in front of the dying fire. "Lewis, what are you..." "You'll see." On the left side of the hearth, the fire was out, and there was a thick bed of fluffy gray ashes. Lewis stamped the boot into them, leaving a deep track. Then he tromped the boot down on the outer bricks, using it like a big rubber stamp. "There," he said, after he had put the boot away in the closet again. "You like?" Rachel was giggling again. "Lewis, Ellie's going to go nuts." During the last 2 weeks of school, Ellie had picked up a disquieting rumor around kindergarten, to wit, that Santa Claus was really parents. This idea had been reinforced by a rather skinny Santa at the Bangor Mall, whom Ellie had glimpsed in the Deering ice cream parlor a few days ago. Santa had been sitting on a counter stool, his beard pulled to one side so he could eat a cheeseburger. This had troubled Ellie mightily. It seemed to be the cheeseburger somehow, even more than the false beard, in spite of Rachel's assurances that the department store and Salvation Army Santas were really helpers, sent out by the real Santa, who was far too busy completing inventory and reading children's last-minute letters up north to be boogieing around the world on public relations jaunts. Lois replaced the fire screen carefully. Now there were two clear boot tracks in their fireplace, one in the ashes and one on the hearth. They both pointed toward the Christmas tree, as if Santa had hit bottom on one foot and immediately stepped out to leave the goodies assigned to the Creed household. The illusion was perfect, unless you happen to notice that they were both left feet, and Lewis doubted if Ellie was that analytical. "Lewis Creed, I love you," Rachel said and kissed him. "You married a winner, baby," Lewis said, smiling sincerely. "Stick with me and I'll make you a star." They started with the stairs. He pointed at the card table Ellie had set up in front of the TV. There were oatmeal cookies and two ring-dings on it. Also a can of Michelob. "For you, Santa," the note said in Ellie's large, stick-like printing. "You want a cookie or a ring-ding?" "Ring-ding," she said and ate half of it. Lewis popped the tab on the beer. "A beer this late is going to give me acid indigestion," he said. "Crap," she said good-humoredly. "Come on, Doc." Lewis put down the can of beer and suddenly grasped the pocket of his robe as if he had forgotten something, although he had been aware of that small packet of weight all evening long. "Here," he said. "For you. You can open it now. It's after midnight. Merry Christmas, babe." She turned the little box, wrapped up in silver paper and tied with wide, satiny blue ribbon, in her hands. "Lewis, what is it?" He shrugged. "Soap. Shampoo sample. I forget exactly." She opened it on the stairs, saw the Tiffany box, and squealed. She pulled out the cotton batting, and then just stood there, her mouth slightly agape. "Well?" he asked anxiously. He never bought her a real piece of jewelry before, and he was nervous. "Do you like it?" She took it out, draped the fine gold chain over her tented fingers, and held the tiny sapphire up to the hall light. It twirled lazily, seeming to shoot off cool blue rays. "Oh, Lewis, it's so damn beautiful." He saw she was crying a little and felt both touched and alarmed. "Hey, babe, don't do that," he said. "Put it on." "Lewis, we can't afford..." "You can't afford..." "Shh," he said. "I socked some money away off and on since last Christmas, and it wasn't as much as you might think." "How much was it?" "I'll never tell you that, Rachel," he said solemnly. "An army of Chinese torturers couldn't get it out of me. $2,000. $2,000? She hugged him so suddenly and so tightly that he almost fell down the stairs. "Lewis, you're crazy." "Put it on," he said again. She did. He helped her with a clasp, and then she turned around to look at him. "I want to go up and look at it," she said. "I think I want to preen." "Preen away," he said. "I'll put out the cat and get the lights." "When we make it," she said, looking directly into his eyes, "I'm to take everything off except this." "Preen in a hurry, then," Lewis said, and she laughed. He grabbed Church and draped it over his arm. He didn't bother much with the broom these days. He supposed that, in spite of everything, he had almost gotten used to the cat again. He went toward the entryway door, turning off lights as he went. When he opened the door communicating between the kitchen and garage, an eddy of cold air swirled around his ankles. "Have a Merry Christmas, Ch—" he broke off. Lying on the welcome mat was a dead crow. Its head was mangled. One wing had been ripped off and lay behind the body like a charred piece of paper. Church immediately squirmed out of Lewis's arms and began to nuzzle the frozen corpse eagerly. As Lewis watched, the cat's head darted forward, its ears laid back, and before he could turn his head, Church had ripped out one of the crow's milky glazed eyes. "Church strikes again," Lewis thought a little sickly, and turned his head. Not, however, before he had seen the bloody gaping socket where the crow's eye had been. "Shouldn't bother me. Shouldn't. I've seen worse. Oh, yeah. Pascal, for instance. Pascal was worse, a lot worse. But it did bother him. His stomach turned over. The warm build of sexual excitement had suddenly deflated. Christ, that bird's damn near as big as he is. Must have caught it with its guard down. Way, way down. This would have to be cleaned up. Nobody needed this sort of present on Christmas morning. And it was his responsibility, wasn't it? Sure was. His and nobody else's. He had recognized that much in a subconscious way, even on the evening of his family's return, when he had purposely spilled the tires over the tattered body of the mouse Church had killed. The soil of a man's heart is stonier, Lewis. This thought was so clear, somehow so three-dimensional and auditory, that Lewis jerked a little, as if Judd had materialized at his shoulder and spoken aloud. A man grows what he can, and tends it. Church was still hunched greedily over the dead bird. He was working at the other wing now. There was a tenebrous, rustling sound as Church pulled it back and forth, back and forth. Never get it off the ground, Orville. That's right, Wilbur. Fucking bird's just as dead as dog shit. Might as well feed it to the cat. Might as well... Lewis suddenly kicked Church. Kicked him hard. The cat's hindquarters rose and came down splay-footed. It walked away, spurring him another of its ugly yellow-green glances. Eat me, Lewis hissed at it, cat-like himself. Lewis? Rachel's voice came faintly from their bedroom. Coming to bed? Be right there, he called back. I've just got this little mess to clean up, Rachel, okay? Because it's my mess. He fumbled for the switch that controlled the garage light. He went quickly back to the cupboard under the kitchen sink and got a green hefty bag. He took the bag into the garage and took the shovel down from its nail on the garage wall. He scraped up the crow and dropped it into the bag. Then he shoveled up the severed wing and slipped that in. He tied a knot in the top of the bag and dropped it into the bin on the far side of the Civic. By the time he had finished, his ankles were growing numb. Church was standing by the garage doorway. Lewis made a threatening gesture at the cat with the shovel, and it was gone like black water. Upstairs, Rachel was lying on her bed, wearing nothing but the sapphire on its chain, as promised. She smiled at him lazily. "What took you so long, Chief?" The light over the sink was out, Lewis said. I changed the bulb. Come here, she said, and tugged him gently toward her. Not by the hand. He knows if you've been sleeping, she sang softly. A little smile curved up the corners of her lips. He knows if you're awake. Oh, my, Lewis, dear, what's this? Something that just woke up, I think, Lewis said, slipping off his robe. Maybe we ought to see if we can get it to sleep before Santa comes. What do you think? She rose on one elbow. He felt her breath, warm and sweet. He knows if you've been bad or good, so be good, for goodness sake. Have you been a good boy, Lewis? I think so, he said. His voice was not quite steady. Let's see if you taste as good as you look, she said. The sex was good, but Lewis did not find himself simply slipping off afterward as he usually did when the sex was good. Slipping off easy with himself, his wife, his life. He lay in the darkness of Christmas morning, listening to Rachel's breathing slow and deep, and he thought about the dead bird on the doorstep. Church's Christmas present to him. Keep me in mind, Dr. Creed. I was alive and then I was dead, and now I'm alive again. I've made the circuit, and I'm here to tell you that you come out the other side with your purr box broken and a taste for the hunt. I'm here to tell you that a man grows what he can and tends it. Don't forget that, Dr. Creed. I'm part of what your heart will grow now. There's your wife and your daughter and your son. And there's me. Remember the secret and tend your garden well. At some point, Lewis slept.